We'll move now to the fifth case of the morning, number 013800, the Irwin against the United States.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Bill Tite, and I represent Sonia Irwin. In Ms. Irwin's case, the government had a case with very strong emotional appeal, but the government's case had many legal and factual problems with it, and for that reason, Ms. Irwin needed competent counsel to deal with those problems. In fact, what happened in this case is that her counsel did very little. This morning, I'd like to focus on his handling of the knowledge issue, since that seems to be the one that drew the most attention from the district court, although I really would urge the court to think about this case in its totality. On the knowledge issue, counsel virtually conceded the field. There was very little that was done. There was a stipulation that went directly to the issue of knowledge. And indeed, the district court never really made a finding that counsel served Ms. Irwin well in this case. All that the district court really found at the end, and it's a very short oral opinion, is that if counsel had really tried to do something on this issue, that the government could have counterattacked. And we submit that decision was incorrect and should be reversed. This court gives de novo review to the district court's judgment on this issue. And the question is, if her counsel had done the right thing, would there have been a substantial chance of acquittal? It's not a question of, is there enough evidence to sustain the verdict, because this court has already found that there is, and that was never the issue during the 2255 proceeding. And we submit that in this case, there really was sufficient evidence to support the proposition that good counsel could have made a difference. I think we should remember that by the time this case was decided on appeal, and certainly even by the time of indictment, it was a working proposition that Gregory Schell was the number one person or the number two person, depending on how you count in prison, out of prison, of this huge $100 million deal drug organization. But the real question for defending Ms. Irwin was, what did she know at the time that she bought this restaurant in 1993? What sort of knowledge did she have? Interestingly enough, the government has always been very cagey as to when Gregory Schell came to this exalted position. We have statements that it was sometime in the 90s. We have statements that it was sometime in approximately 1990. But the government has never taken a position as to when he came to that sort of position within the gang. And that's important because it bears on what is the sort of knowledge that she had. Now, her counsel virtually conceded the issue, and the district court was troubled by that. And the district court said, tell me a little bit more. What could the government have done if counsel had put up a fight? And what the government did was come back with an affidavit from one of its investigators saying, well, I could have looked at rap sheets. I could have looked at arrest cards. I could have looked at some other things. And once again, the government law enforcement agent was being very cagey and really didn't say, I did look at these things, or I did find things that would bear as to people's knowledge. And in response to that, the defense went out and subpoenaed certain records. And lo and behold, we subpoenaed what are called the synoptic reports. And they're part of the record before this court. They're about 8 or 9 inches thick. Most of them are double-sided. The first reaction I think anyone would have from looking at these records was, my gosh, I hope in the year 2002 the Chicago Police Department does a better job of keeping track of these things. Because what happens is, within each area of the city, within each precinct, people are writing reports. They're not sharing them with each other. They're not readily available to each other. And if you go to the reports for the West Side, where Ms. Irwin was working as a gang crimes tactical officer, not an investigator the way her counsel seemed to stipulate, there was no mention of Gregory Schell. Her supervisor had never heard of Gregory Schell. It was determined that when Internal Affairs had investigated her in 1991 for possibly having some dealings with Shell, the person who initiated the investigation, who was a lieutenant in Gang Crime South, how did he describe Gregory Shell? He didn't describe him as the head of the Gangster Disciples. He didn't even describe him as someone who was a leader in the Gangster Disciples. He said he's someone who's a known drug dealer. So in 1991, supervisors, investigators, have no inkling as to who Gregory Shell is. And that is the sort of knowledge and lack of knowledge that this case totally glossed over, because counsel sat on his hands. Counsel didn't do anything. Counsel was willing to stipulate. In fact, and I hope I'm not being too petty, he was so lazy about this, he didn't even enter into the stipulation. One of the co-defendant's lawyers is the only person on record agreeing to this stipulation. If he had put up a fight on this knowledge issue, all the government would have been able to prove was that Gregory Shell was someone who, by the time of the trial, was a big shot in the Gangster Disciples, and that Ms. Irwin was a member of the Chicago Police Department. But if there hadn't been these confessions, it would have come out it wasn't her job to investigate. It was part of a Chicago Police Department manual. The rap sheet said nothing about Gregory Shell's position. There were no records that she had ever accessed the rap sheet. No one ever claimed that she did something that would have been so extraordinary that tongues would have been wagging all throughout the department, namely traveling to three different police departments and saying to the commander in each of these areas of the city, let me look at those synoptic reports that investigators write. I'm a lowly tactical officer, but I decide I'm dropping in today and I'd like to look at those reports. The government would have had none of that. And just to bring it back to what the government relied on the most, that conversation where she's mad at Shell, and she's mad at him because the punks are doing something. And, you know, maybe we can all assume the punks are dealing drugs, the punks are talking about drugs, but she's mad at him. And what does her counsel say in defense to that? Instead of saying the most obvious thing, which the district court itself pointed out, was that she first learned about this and she was upset about it, she'd been double-crossed, all he can say is, well, who in their right mind would ever say something like that? Well, gee whiz, counsel, it's not as if we've got some flipper who came in and asserted she said something like this. We had a tape playing in the courtroom with her voice, and there was a reasonable, plausible explanation, but only if you did the investigation, only if you put the government to its proof, and only perhaps if you marshaled whatever proof you needed to marshal if you couldn't get it on cross-examination. Her counsel didn't do any of these things. He let the government run roughshod over her. The district court had it right when it said initially, you know, I'm troubled by this, I want more evidence. When the government came back with its so-called additional evidence, it really did not tip the scales. The district court should have gone with its original inclination. And I'd ask this court to reverse and grant the writ. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tice. We'll hear now from Mr. Bindi.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. The benchmark for effective assistance of counsel under the Sixth Amendment is reasonableness. Mr. Boyd defended this case on the theory that Sonia Irwin, whatever she might have known about Greg Shell and who he was and what he was doing, acted as she did during the years that she lived with him because she loved him, that her intent was to promote domestic harmony, not the Gangster Disciples. Given the evidence in this case, that was a reasonable theory of defense. Ms. Irwin now believes that instead her attorney should have attempted to mount a lack of knowledge defense, a defense based on the notion that she had no idea who he really was and what he was really doing. We submit that such a defense would have quickly lost credibility with the jury. You start off with one strike against you, which is that although a woman living with a man for 3 years and having no idea what he does for a living is not unheard of, it is in fact extraordinary. It is very unusual. The defense would have been centered around the testimony of Sergeant Magaha, who was Sonia Irwin's supervisor in Gang Crimes West. Officer Magaha testified at the 2255 proceedings that while he had some knowledge of the gangster disciples and he knew who Larry Hoover was, he didn't know who Gregory Schell was. Well, Your Honors, Sergeant Magaha did not live with Gregory Schell for 3 years. When the condominium that Sonia Irwin and Greg Schell shared for 3 years was searched in August 1995, following the return of the indictment, papers were discovered there showing that Greg Schell was a public aid recipient. There was evidence admitted at trial in the form of a tape, a conversation between Greg Schell and another woman, in which Greg Schell had said that he told the public aid authorities that he'd been on public aid virtually his entire adult life. He'd never held a job. And yet Greg Schell showed up at the public aid office in a silk suit and alligator shoes, gold and diamond jewelry, and a Rolex watch. There is evidence in this case, specifically from the tapes, that it was not unusual for Greg Schell to dress this way. Now, Sonia Irwin, putting these two facts together, that had to raise some kind of question in her mind about what Greg Schell did. So this kind of defense, we submit, would have quickly lost credibility with the jury. In addition to that, of course, you have the tapes in which she is angrily threatening Greg Schell. And again, those tapes can be looked at as either a woman scorned or a woman who has just found out now that the man she lives with is not the law-abiding citizen but is instead Shorty G. By far, the more reasonable interpretation of those tapes is that Sonia Irwin is incensed because she has discovered that Greg Schell has been unfaithful to her, and she is telling him in those tapes that she is no longer going to accommodate what she knows to be going on at that restaurant, which is that it is a communications and meeting place for gangster disciples. Had a lack of knowledge defense been presented, the government presented, in addition to information about synoptic reports, the following in the 2255 proceedings as things that would have been brought out had this defense been presented. There was the IAD investigation, which resulted in 1994 in a reprimand to Sonia Irwin, a written reprimand, which she signed as having received. And that reprimand says that the reason she's being reprimanded is because she had made efforts to post bond for Gregory Schell, a, quote, high-ranking member of the gangster disciple. In addition to that, there would have been the proffer, which she gave before trial, in which she basically admitted that she knew that Greg Schell was a drug dealer and a gangster disciple. I think, Your Honors, that it is undisputed that at least as of the time of those angry phone conversations that were taped, and that's July of 1994, at least as of that time, she knew what was going on. A lack of knowledge prior to that defense, therefore, is no defense at all. It's a plea of guilty because she continued for another year to allow that restaurant to be used as it was. Now, Ms. Irwin believes today that the key thing, the crucial thing, was her knowledge at the time of the transaction in which she acquired an interest in that restaurant, and that was, I think, December of 1993. That was never the government's theory, that that was the critical thing, that her acquisition of the restaurant, or an interest in the restaurant, or a nominal interest in the restaurant, was what aided and abetted the conspiracy. What aided and abetted the conspiracy was, first of all, the nominal, the fact that it was in her name. So that insulated Greg Schell and the gangster disciples at least somewhat. And the fact that for years she allowed them to use the restaurant as they did. That was the government's theory. Therefore, even if she didn't acquire knowledge until sometime after the acquisition, even if she didn't know until July of 1994, and certainly she knew as of October 1994 when she got that reprimand for bonding out a high-ranking member of the gangster disciples, her continued acquiescence in what was going on, her continued promotion of what was going on after that until the arrest in August of 1995 makes her guilty.
How do you characterize at least her claim that she was insisting no collect calls from the prison as a way that she was trying to not be part of this operation?
The argument there is that by blocking incoming long-distance calls, she was taking an action that was actually contrary to the interests of the conspiracy. That's not true, because it didn't do anything to block incoming calls from prisons. Anybody who wanted to make a collect call, whether it was Hoover or any other member who was incarcerated, and contact the gang on the street through the restaurant, all they had to do is precisely what Larry Hoover did in this case, which is call somebody else who will accept the charges and have that person call the restaurant, make it a three-way call. There was a tape of such a conversation involving Hoover that was admitted in this case. Wendy Jenkins, Hoover's wife, is the one who picked up the long-distance charges for that, and then it was a local call from her house to the restaurant. So blocking incoming calls did nothing more than keep the phone bill at the restaurant down.
Well, was that was supposedly, at least I think her claim, is that meant that she was trying to keep the place from being used by the criminals. I guess your argument would be that if you accepted collect calls from the prison, it's an acknowledgement or admission that they're in cahoots. I mean, if you accept collect calls from the prison, you can't say that you don't know there's something wrong here.
That's true.
And I wondered if that could be argued, at least, and it would be why the counsel did not bring it up.
I think it's logical collect calls coming from prisons to the restaurant might have been viewed as a potential red flag, and therefore having those calls going to members of the community, Hoover calling his wife, and then his wife calling the restaurant and making it a three-way call, it could have been done as a security measure. But certainly it was not something that hindered in any way, shape, or form the use of the restaurant as a communication center for gang activity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bindi. How much time does Mr. Tice have?
2.5 minutes.
Thank you.
As always seems to happen in this case, because it is so multifaceted, when you push the government one way, they sort of go in a different direction. And this morning, and they did this in the briefs too, it's not any surprise, they say, well, even if she didn't have knowledge at the time she purchased the restaurant, she had the knowledge as of the time of that phone call almost a year later, and that's what makes her guilty. And they say that it was always their theory that it was not only buying it, but it was continuing to own it that made her guilty. If you look closely at the record, or as I look closely at the record, I would disagree with that. It was always the government's theory that she bought the restaurant, and that's what provided the cover. And the government would have had a very hard time in front of the jury in shifting their position. And apart from the tactical disadvantages of trying to shift their position, they would have had some real factual problems in shifting their position. Because, remember, once again, her lawyer sat down on the job. He let them get away with a theory, she bought a restaurant. Nonsense. She never bought a restaurant. She bought some equipment, and that's all we have in the record. There's nothing in the record that she signed a lease. There's nothing that she filed tax returns in her name or Shell's name. The police department investigated her, and they could never find any tie between her and the restaurant. So a year later, when she gets this knowledge, the government says, well, she kept owning the restaurant. That makes her guilty. Well, as of then, there was nothing she could do to make herself either more aligned with the restaurant or, for that matter, less aligned with the restaurant. This was another one of these red herrings, some smoke that the government put into its case, and her counsel never did anything to come to grips with it. Her counsel failed to think about the government's case in the most basic sense. The lawyer just bought in to these slogans, these shibboleths. She bought a restaurant. Oh, well, she bought a restaurant. I guess that's the working premise I have to go on as a defense counsel. He didn't do his job, and that last defense by the government illustrates once again that he didn't do his job. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tice. Thank you, Mr. Bindi. The case will be taken under advisement.